Okay, so welcome back.
So number three of three. I'll just, while everyone's finishing getting up their coffee, just start with a story. But someone left me a voicemail this morning. You know, whenever you're holding it, something, you just see it everywhere. That's usually the way that goes. So he left me a voicemail this morning that he had... in the beginning of our Seder, the beginning of learning this morning, he had walked past one of the guys in the kollel who was learning, and he said something to him, complimentary about how he was learning or something. He didn't remember the details, where he said something nice to this guy, this other rabbi in the kollel who was doing something. So he said, didn't think anything of it, except that he got an email from this rav later in the day saying that, "I just want to thank you for what you said to me this morning. It totally changed my entire day." And so it was very meaningful. He said that. Thank you very much. So Rav Shlomo left me a voicemail saying, like, this is, like, here I said this small little thing to a guy who's learning, he's in the kollel, he's an older guy, he's not, like, and it had such an impact on him that it was worth it for him to send me off another email saying, "You totally changed my day when you said that to me. Thank you for taking the time to say that." So Rav Shlomo said to me, we forget and we take for granted how starved we all are as people for compliments, how much we crave attention, recognition of things it is that we're doing, and that when we receive that, how powerful it is when you actually get that. And he has said that he has just seen that time and time again, and he often just randomly leaves me these voicemails, like, don't forget how important that is. When you do that and you accomplish that, what an impact it leaves. And it struck me that here I am returning today from a week and a half in Eretz Yisrael. So, of course, any husband knows, you know, you got to come back with something if you're a wife. Sure, you got to come back with something. But I was just sort of like, I'm sure you did. I'm
your husband, I didn't.
I know how much you shop. I am very confident. So, but here I was really about to just take this bag, which is gift wrapped by the store, and just, that's what I was ready to do, and just sort of like hand it over and say, thank you. As opposed to, you know, maybe I should actually, like, write out a card and say, like, what an amazing thing, like, I left and you have it by yourself, you got all the kids. It's not such a simple thing. And it hadn't occurred to me to do that until Rav Shlomo left me that message, that there's an appropriate way of saying thank you, and admiration and recognition and acknowledgement of what's going on. And that's everything that we've been speaking about until this point, of building that up, that we take our spouses for granted so often, and the building blocks of friendship is that feeling of recognition, of being acknowledged, and how important it was. And it was just this morning, as I'm sitting here preparing this, that Rabbi Feldman randomly leaving me a voicemail, and it's a reminder. You just constantly have to be on top of that, of understanding, recognizing, constantly putting in writing, whatever love language your spouse may speak of how to say that, but that always needs to be done. Okay. Let's start off with just pick one and pass one around. I'll keep one for myself. Go both ways. Started with this little activity. You know, I got about eight emails back from the feedback, so it was a perfect bell curve as far as pace goes. Out of the eight that I received, so four people said the pace was perfect, two said it was too fast, and two said it was too slow. So I guess that's exactly where I want to be, and I'm right in the middle of the bell curve, and I'll wait to hear from the others. So I won't have a lot to do with it. Okay, the Gatman Island survival game. So as you can read in front of you, imagine your cruise ship has just sank in the Caribbean and you're waking to find yourselves on a tropical desert island. Gilligan and Ginger nowhere to be found. The two of you are the only survivors. You have no idea where you are. You think there's... Everyone have a pen, by the way? You'll need a little pen for this. You think there's some chance that people know of the ship's distress, but you're not sure. A storm appears to be on the way. You decide you need to be prepared to survive on the island for some time and also make sure you'll be spotted by a rescue team. Should be a period there. There's a bunch of stuff from the ship on the island that could help you. But together, you and your spouse can only carry 10 items. Circle the number of the 10 most important items that you feel the two of you should take. There are no right or wrong answers, obviously. You do not work together. This is to be worked on individually. The 10 things that you think... Now again, obviously, there are no right or wrong answers. Somebody who doesn't know how to use, let's just take an example, a small life raft with a sail, might not think that'd be valuable to them. So there are no right or wrong answers. This is for you and your spouse, but you're answering for yourself. what you think the two of you should take together. You could just circle the numbers. You don't have to circle the whole thing. Just circle the numbers around your top 10 things that you think you would need, not knowing how long you'll be out there, and preparing yourself for what you need. 10. Obviously, we would be better to have more than 10. Just choose your top 10.
Should we circle the things we think
ourselves? No. What you individually think, you the two of you should work together.
Right.
Now, you need to be prepared. You need to take care of your wife. So if there's something on that list that you think she needs, that should be on your list. But you individually, what you think you need.
I'm sorry. I should try and think of what she's bringing and bring something different.
No. You only get 10. You're not going to get, no, that doesn't work that way.
Well, I'm under pressure.
He's going to be a lawyer. Okay, just for the Hebrew is Kitta Shulchan Aruch, anyone who's not familiar, that's just your whatever version of language you'd rather prefer. With that's number 16, by the way, gives you a summary of all the daily laws you would need, daily and Shabbos halachos, as it would be relevant. I think everything else is self-explanatory. Give you another minute or two.
Is the radio full of batteries?
Yes.
Can we get accent?
Can you get what?
Accent.
Satellite radio?
You know the punchline for the story, right?
No.
People aren't worried about being saved because they've been pledged to the Federation and they'll find them.
No. Not if it was a pledge that I made. They're not going to come looking for me. Basically done. No, we're still working hard. No, there's no right. That I disagree with that. In other words, like I would need two sets of clothing for my wife. You have to know what's going on. That's, yeah, I don't know.
Backpack, shoes.
Right.
These are trained to ask questions.
Okay, did everyone finish? 30 seconds, choose your top 10. You're not going to be graded on this, so like, don't. Wait.
Okay,
I'm going to click in afterwards and psychoanalyze you, but that's for later. That's not for right now. Now you should have your top 10, and it'll force you to just finish your circle. Now, the next part of this, and this is the fun part, is you now have to compare with your spouse the 10, go over the ones that you both had that were the same, you could look at each other's, and then you have 5 minutes to come to a consensus as to the 10 that you're going to take based on the ones that you together. In other words, you probably should have, I'm guessing, I don't know, anywhere between 3 and 6 that probably were the same, and then you need to work out from the other ones that you chose, come to a discussion as to which ones you should need. You can argue your cases why you should take the ones that you chose and figure out which ones you want to do. 5 minutes.
Yeah.
You'll just have to figure out what Sandy said.
She's just too worn out for
that. 10 left. 1. 9. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10. 10.
the go with the game. You need to come to you have to come to 10. You both thought that something was more important, so you have to figure out how you want to deal with it. How many did you start off with the same? 7. No, no, neither. You guys go camping a lot, and you know what you need. Yeah, no, there are a couple here that you obviously don't need, but. Take a longer rabbi? No, I'm not going to be stuck on such an island. Are they from today's thing or from Israel? I didn't know. I saw my blackbird that it came. I don't know. From today's preschool event or from the trip? So then it's reporting to my house, and that's my ethnic team. Alright, one more minute.
This takes a lot longer than picking her up.
That's true. I forgot that there was somebody, you know, when I arranged to do it on this night, I figured to myself, I'll be fine. And I didn't realize that somebody who was going on the trip might also like be part of this group. That was probably not nice.
It worked well for me. I had a fun last year. And when I saw this, I realized we're out of the United States. We're not that funny.
Worked out well. Okay, you guys done? How many did you start out with? 6 were the same? Finished? How many started out with the same? 8 were the same. Nice. Done? How many started out with the same?
8.
Also 8. 10 members, you guys done? 30 seconds. You guys finished? We all did. Okay, ladies. 15 seconds. Make your final argument. That was 4. You have to work out 6. Okay. Alright, this is, I think, a very interesting little exercise that that he creates. Now, the point of this exercise, as you've probably figured out by now, really has nothing to do with what you think you need to survive on an island, but how you work out, the two of you, convincing each other and debating and coming to a conclusion as to which items should or should not be chosen. Now, Gavin would actually give the following questionnaire, which I will run through the questions with you, and then you'd actually have to rate it, and he would then give you a whole score. But it would be as follows. There is a multiple choice to the following questions. Number 1, how effective do you think you were at influencing your spouse? Meaning this is a question directed to you individually. How effective were you in influencing your spouse? Not at all. Par, neither effective nor ineffective. Somewhat effective or very effective. That's the question. Like how you were at influencing your spouse. How effective was your spouse at influencing you?
Some of the questions would be like, how much did the man lose by?
Did either of you try to dominate the other, or were you equally competitive with each other's answers? I was very much competitive. That's why, no, not the trend, like not at all. It wasn't competitive. In other words, it was equally competitive. We were never dominant. Did either of you sulk or withdraw from the debates? Did you have fun? A little bit, not at all. A lot, somewhat. Did you work well as a team? Did you feel both included in the discussion? Did you or your partner have any irritability in the discussion? So this was sort of light and fairly easy going through, but as you could just hear from the questions that are being asked, what's being driven home is when you have these debates, is there one or the other who is dominating, forcing their will over the other? This wasn't fun. This was a sense of being forced into agreeing to something. My influence, I felt I was being influenced, but didn't have an ability to influence at all. As we started last week, the next part of what we're going to be talking about is the idea of managing conflict. The conflict will be there. This is a great little exercise. You have a task in front of you. Two separate opinions, you know, the good ones. I don't know, somehow you guys came up with eight of the same, pretty impressive. You only have to work out two. That's pretty easy. You guys have much less of the similar ones. You have to work out a lot more. These are common things that happen in life all the time. How it happens, how one, in his terminology of accepting influence, being able to hear the perspective of someone else, being able to integrate that and then come to a conclusion where you're both coming to the table clearly with different opinions and approaches as to what's going on, and how you're able to do that is the issue. So what I want to do now is go through a number of concepts that Gottman discusses. A lot of the concepts are going to be familiar to you. Whether or not they'll be familiar from the actual terminology that he uses, some of it will definitely be new, some of it will be common. What I find most helpful in this is that it gave me, just as far as when I learned this and have used it in my own personal life, it gives me a vocabulary and the tools to understand what's going on. Very often when we get into little disputes or conflicts, we get stuck, and it's very hard to put your finger on where the problem is or why there's a problem. And when you can't put your finger on that, it's hard to really then move past it because you're not really sure where to go. So I want to go through some of these ideas, and that I think will help work through that gridlock. The basic underlying approach that I personally have, he doesn't express this directly, is that everybody here really are good people, really love each other as a spouse, and want things to work out. There are things which get in the way, he'll go through, which really are that problem. There's something which prevents that from happening, even though in the underlying cause of things, things really can work out and should work out. And it's the vocabulary that we need to be able to discuss them is that I want to go through. So I just want to go through a couple of the concepts. Some are going to be more familiar again, as I mentioned, as follows. I wanted to also just mention in the book, because everyone mentioned, as I expected, like, what does this book have to do with anything? I haven't really been using it so much. If you'll just flip quickly, just to go through for those of you who have it here, it is table of contents. It's on page 5 and 6 and 7. So what he did is in chapters 2, 3, 4, and 5 are the first half of the session which we did, which was discussing developing your friendship, creating the positive environment in your home, which is really the bedrock of a healthy marriage, especially as the children come and they grow and they create a difficulty of that relationship. Those chapters are basically what we went through, chapter 2, the love maps, the fondness and admiration system, bids and turning towards. All of that was based on here, if you want to go back and review that. That first building block of creating that friendship. I skipped over chapter 6, which is the baby blues and postpartum mood disorders. You're welcome to look at that if you'd like. And what I'm doing now is chapters 9, 10, and 11, which is managing conflict. The first basic component is developing friendship, making sure that you maintain contact and develop that. And the second half is managing the conflict, which is what I want to do. We started yet last time, and then we'll finish with 9, 10, and 11, maybe we'll touch some of the last things if we have time in the end. If you want to flip to page 89, it's chapter 9. You can follow on the side just to get a sense of where I'm going. Okay, let's start with criticism, the concept of criticism. Now, criticism is obviously a negative thing. We don't appreciate criticism. We don't like getting it. But there's a massive distinction, and this has been made famous by the psychologists since the 60s, so a lot of us have come across this in different arenas. The difference between criticism and a complaint. A complaint is fair. We all have complaints. We will have complaints in life, specifically directed at our spouse. Our spouse will do things wrong, forget things, say things they weren't supposed to say, don't say things they should be saying, and we have a complaint. A complaint is always on a very specific action that was or that wasn't done, and it describes the problem. For example, husband forgets to go shopping on his way home for work, happens all the time. Thursday night, you're cooking for Shabbos, and now you don't have the ingredients that you asked him to get, and it's going to throw everything off, and I got to work on it tomorrow, whatever. It is totally fair to say something along the lines of, I am so upset that you forgot to go shopping. I needed those ingredients. That's fair. That's a complaint. I'm upset that you haven't done it. I can express my feelings that you haven't done it. I stated what you didn't do, and that I needed it. It is totally fair for a husband to say to his wife, you know, we agreed that we were going to this wedding on time. You know how much I hate walking in late. There's a specific issue. This wedding, we got there late, and it didn't happen, and it is a fair thing for someone to complain. Can't stand when you leave your dirty clothing on the floor. I've asked you a bunch of times to please clean them up. When we receive that kind of complaint, when we hear that, what kind of reaction do you get when you hear that? Let me say, if I were to say that, I asked you 10 times, please clean up your clothing from the floor. I really don't like when it's left there. So now you can feel defensive and you can feel like a baby, but I want to compare that to when you get a criticism. That's really a complaint. I've asked you to pick him up and you didn't pick him up, so you could feel like a baby. That's fair. If I've asked you a couple of times to do something and you didn't do it, that's a fine feeling that you should have, because I'm not asking something unreasonable, right? I'm asking you, I mean, is that a fair, would people agree that that's a fair feeling to have? Like, I've asked you to do something and you didn't do it, and I call you on it. And it was a reasonable request to make. So I think it's fair you feel like a baby. When you feel like a baby, what will that hopefully inspire you to do? You can cry. So hopefully, you know, hopefully it'll inspire you to change something about it. Hopefully it won't. But it's not an unfair feeling to feel like a baby if you've acted like a baby. Because I've asked you to do it and you didn't take care of it. When we criticize, in the terminology, and this is, you know, we could work on the actual definition. When we criticize, we make a little bit more of a global statement. I'm not just defining an activity that I've asked you to do something and you didn't do it, or something wasn't done in a specific manner. I globalize it and define you as a person, personality, trait, or characteristic because of the fact that you haven't done it. It would sound something more like, why are you always so forgetful? I asked you to go shopping on the way home. When I say something like that, and I'm defining you, that you are a forgetful person, or I say something like, you always leave the house a mess. How many times have I asked you to pick it up? And I define always, never, those kinds of words in which I'm no longer giving a specific example and describing something that has happened, but am globally assessing you as a person, and it's usually done in a fairly negative way. You're never ready on time. We're always late. When you hear those statements, what's the knee-jerk reaction to that?
No,
not. Right? It's always going to be some form of defensiveness. It always is, because you're attacking me as a person. You're not saying, listen, I asked you to pick it up and you didn't do it, which, if you feel like a baby, all right, that's fair. I mean, that happens sometimes in life. But when I define you with the never, always, or I put a label on you as a person, so then the feeling that we have is really one in which we begin to shut down. We can't really cope. We don't react well to those kinds of comments. The psychologists have long pointed out this as well before Gottman. Anyone who's taken any psychologist classes or have read parenting books will commonly hear the difference between the I statements and the you statements. When you start a statement with you always, you never, it's very easily gets into these global assessments in which we define someone. And it always is taken in a negative, not always, it hurts. The person who hears it usually takes it in a much more powerful way as opposed to the I statements. I need you to pick up the clothing when I ask you to do that. I need you to go shopping. I need you to do that. I don't like it when you do this. I just had a situation when I was in Israel. So a friend of mine, their child, were sitting at the table and kept trying to get my attention. I was like looking at my friend trying to have a conversation at Shabbos Shif, and this little 6-year-old kept putting his hand on my face and turning my face towards him. So how do you react to someone else's child at their table doing something which I personally felt was inappropriate. You can debate whether or not that is or isn't appropriate, but how do you respond as the adult to a child whose first time I ignored it, and they did it a second time and a third time? So how do you respond in an appropriate way to a child who does that? So I think the appropriate response would be, I don't like it when you do that. I didn't say that at the time because I was so thrown off. I'm in this person's house and his child is in that. I couldn't think of anything to say, so I totally left that. I didn't want to get involved. I said nothing. He didn't say anything and I didn't say anything. And it was like about 15 minutes later that it came to me, like, that's what I needed to say. And I did not have it at the tip of my tongue, but that's the way I needed to respond. But in thinking about it at the table later, that's what, you know, I don't like it when you do that. Not, you're being disgusting, you're annoying. Like, that's usually what would come out. You're annoying me. You're annoying me comes out a lot harsher than something along the lines of, I don't like it when you do that. Which I think is the more appropriate response. Before you even get into marriage, if you pay attention to the way that we talk, hold on one second. The other thing in terms of defining a difference between criticism and a complaint is that a complaint, which is more valid, always defines specifically a situation, as opposed to a criticism always makes it more global. You want to focus on describing what it was that was done or that wasn't done and why it is that you do or you don't like that. And the best way to describe that really is the way that we respond to our children. It's really a classic Chaim Ginat, if you've seen his books, was a child psychologist who writes extensively about this in terms of even when we praise children, learning to praise them by describing what they did and not judging or evaluating them. Because most of the time when we respond, a lot of times what we do is we actually evaluate or define what it is that I love that painting. Even when you're praising, you say that to a child, what you've basically done is you've taken the painting from what it is and put it into your judgment of what it is. I love that painting. I think that's so nice. As opposed to describing what they did, I see there's a leg and there's an arm and there's a face, and let them come to the conclusion of, I'm such a good artist, as opposed to you're telling them, oh, you're such a good artist, I have now defined, described, judged you, and it's my characterization of you, as opposed to always describing the situation. And I found it very hard to do. I'm familiar, people have read either Chaim Ginat's work or others. It's hard to do, to get into the habit of actually describing the situation. And as much as that's key and critical with our children, it's also in terms of our spouses, to get into the habit when we complain, when we have a complaint, and we have complaints all the time, that's part of married life, things will be done or not done, is to get into the habit of when we complain, not to globalize it as you are lazy, you're a slob, you're a mess, you're always late, you're always so forgetful, and defining the situation as to what took place. Now, why does it so often happen that we burst out into global criticism? So I happen to have been sitting on the plane with a woman named Janice Goldfein, who's a social worker in Detroit, which is sitting next to me, and she saw me with my preparing my book. So she turns out she's part of Nefesh, which is the Orthodox mental health organization, and she's taking many trainings, set of seminars with John Gottman himself. And she says she's a marriage therapist. So I asked her what some of the biggest problems are that she sees. So I'm giving a class, like what's out there? So she said, which fit right into what I was busy preparing, she said the biggest issues that we have is that we have a particular difficulty expressing our needs. We're not good at sharing with our spouses our expectations, the things that we want, the things that we need. And she says she finds over and over again that it's as if we expect our spouse to divine somehow exactly what it is that we wanted or needed or expected, which they, of course, aren't so good at doing. What happens when they don't do that, and we expected it, is we get frustrated and we begin to resent whatever that's going on. But the other party doesn't know that that's what's going on in our heads. We're beginning to get very resentful and very frustrated because something is not happening. But we never expressed it. And when we don't express it, when it begins to happen, it usually happens again. And then it happens again. And by the time it happens 3 or 4 or 5 times where we wanted or needed or thought something was going to happen and it doesn't, so then it's very easy to globalize because it seems it is always happening. Because it just keeps on happening over and over and over again. So she said one of the things that she's always teaching and working with in couples is to be able to express it. When something happens once, learn how to say it in a non-offensive way, that's in the form of a complaint, describing what happened, I don't like it when this happens, I needed this, so that it gets out there what it is that you want, because when you leave it up to the other person's imagination and you expect that your spouse is somehow magically going to be able to come up with it, it usually doesn't happen, and things build, and when they build and they build and they build, it usually explodes, and the way that it explodes into, it explodes into some form of a global criticism of your spouse. Now, what happens once you hear that criticism? Once you get that global complaint, the natural response is, as you said, you get defensive. So that's issue B, if you're just following along on page 90, you get defensive. Now, if you think about defensiveness, when we normally get defensive, that normally happens. You always are so forgetful. You're always lazy. We somehow respond because we don't like being defined in such a way, and we will kick back in some way or another. So in the book, he defines more than he does in his book, but he says there are four types of classic defensive responses when a person feels attacked. When I hear something or someone says something about me, they assess me in a negative way, I will respond in one of four ways. Number one is we attack back. That's the first thing that we do. So for example, if I get attacked that I always forget the shopping list. I came home again, and you're always so forgetful, you're always busy in your own world, busy with other things, you get distracted. So how would I attack back? What does that normally sound like? So in my house, it would sound like, well, you gave me the list only 15 minutes. You would have given me the list earlier in the day. I would have had it written out in the normal place, and instead you gave it to me in some other way, so I wasn't able to do it. Something along those lines. What am I really doing when I say something like that? I'm shifting the blame. It's not really my fault. I'm the one who forgot to go shopping. I got attacked. I had now, when you said to me, I really needed that. I asked you to get it. You forgot. Now I feel like a baby. Now I could accept responsibility. It's easy to accept, not easy. I can accept the responsibility in that situation. It might not be so easy. But it's a lot easier when I attack you and say, you're always so forgetful. I can't count on you for anything. When you say that, you're always going to get defensive. So one way is, you gave me the list. I was in the middle of doing something. When I do that, in essence, what I'm doing is I'm really saying, this is your fault, not my fault. Or we get defensive by proclaiming our innocence. So, you're always late. I'm not always late. Not true. Now, if you tell me when we're walking in late to a wedding, and I say, we're always late, you're never ready on time, and you say, not always late. Again, really what I'm saying is, you're getting all worked up about something which clearly isn't true. It's not my fault. I mean, it happens once in a while, but don't blame me. It's not really true. Or we'll be righteously indignant, says John Gottman, and we'll say something along the lines of, oh, it's late. It's 3 minutes after six. Like, what's the big deal? Tell me you're going to come home and it's 3 minutes. Like, wow. What am I really saying when I say that? You're overreacting. It's totally like, you're the one making a big deal out of nothing. I'm 2 minutes late. That's totally within the social etiquette, reasonability, reason I'm fine. And you're the one who's driving me crazy by being so exact. Or sometimes we'll whine like a victim. It was my boss. It was this. It was some form of a whining. And it's not my fault, which is really not shifting the blame directly to yourself, but it's shifting it to somebody else. In all of these situations, the main thing is when we are attacked, we respond with the defensiveness, and when we're defensive, what we're doing is we're shifting the blame. It's not really my fault, it's somebody else's fault. Most of the time in our defensive responses, we're really saying it's our spouse's fault in some other way. Most of the time, not always, but most of the time in a defensive battle, that's what happens. So now again, Gottman is the researcher, so he's basing this all on the conversations that he's taped in which couples dialogue about their disputes. It says it's no surprise that when one couple gets attacked, one spouse gets attacked, and the other one responds in a defensive way, nothing gets resolved. The conversation doesn't go in. No one, he says, very rarely, if I get defensive and I blame you, do you then step back from your attacking me? I said, you're always late. What is it, 3 minutes after six? You're right, you're not always late. That's not usually the way the conversation goes. Right? That's not what happened. I'm sorry. I didn't realize it's only 3 after 6. Absolutely. Because really, I'm the one being attacked. When you respond in a defensive way, it's almost an attack back at me, that I'm the one who's impossible to deal with. I have to be there, but it's not puzzling. So it always is an escalation of the problem. So when it starts off with an attack, which makes it very difficult for me to be responsible, because when you say I'm always late, when you define me and you criticize me as a person, as a personality trait, that there's a defect in who I am, it's very hard for me to accept responsibility and end the conversation at that point. I'm almost always going to respond in some form of a negative, defensive way, which builds on whatever's going on and escalates whatever the conversation is. And you, as you see these conversations again, as soon as that happens, the ping pong game begins in the dispute, because there's no opportunity for someone to get out of it, because there's a constant escalation.
Wouldn't able to respond to that be like the time and approach, but I'll just use an example of a child. Let's say the child says, you know, you never let me do anything fun. Okay, so I do it fun. Well, yes, I do. There's two more times. Or what kind of not does say is, you seem to feel very upset you can't go to your friend's house. So couldn't you use that same kind of response as well? You seem to be very upset that you're running away.
Yes.
So
Gottman holds, that's a wonderful thing for a therapist to do with a client, and it's a great thing as a parent-child relationship, because you're not equivalent. So I can say to a child that, I don't even know if you can say that to a teenager, I have a feeling that really won't work very well. But to a spouse, for sure not. Like, that's what he says, like many therapies would say, that that's what marriage is about. You have to, oh, I hear you're feeling that. He says, that's what therapists do to a client when they're removed from the situation. I'm an objective third party, and I'm hearing you complain about your spouse or your boss. So I could say, I see that your spouse is driving you crazy. When you're talking about me, it's hard for me to sound authentic and say that without coming out condescending. He doesn't buy that. He doesn't think it works. Does it work? No, it doesn't work, right? Like, I'm angry because I'm holding. I said that we're late. So like, oh, I see that you're late. No, I'm angry. I don't want you to tell me what I'm feeling. I know what I'm feeling. Children also. The reason why Gina says to do that to children is because we are teaching children what their feelings are. They're all. They don't know the difference between frustration, anger, being scared. Part of our job, and that's his approach, is we need to give them the vocabulary to deal with that. I don't want my spouse to tell me that I'm angry. I know that I'm angry. I want her to deal with my anger and respond to it in a way that she acknowledges there's something wrong here, not tell me that I'm feeling angry. That's probably all. Yeah, especially. Yeah. It might be okay for a wife to do it to a husband. It's for sure not okay for a husband to do it to a wife. That's for sure. Okay, so area number four. Number one, if a conversation, now it doesn't have to happen in this particular manner, but there's an issue of criticism. When it comes to criticism, will almost always lead to defensiveness. Now, what eventually sneaks in, and this is the most poisonous of all concepts that Gottman describes, is that of contempt. He says it generally happens in this order, but it doesn't have to, and they're just concepts that happen. Now, contempt, as you're all familiar with that word and what that basically means, is any statement which makes you sound or appear superior to your spouse. It comes in many different forms, but when it sneaks into a conversation, you could basically just pull the plug on the conversation because it is over. Sarcasm, cynicism, the rolling of the eyes, there are facial expressions that you can make, mockery, hostile humor, putting people down. Once that gets in there, there's no response. I can't have a response. When you roll your eyes at me with contempt and say something along the lines of, like, that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard, or that can never work, I don't have a response to that. There is nothing that I can say. Once you have taken the high moral ground and you are better, superior than I am, there's really very little left to say that's productive. So when one spouse, if the issue builds long enough or the conversation gets heated enough where the contempt is there, I would never spend money on something like that. So if one set of comes home with a new purchase and the other one's, I can't, never, when in essence you're saying is,
I'm smarter than you,
bet, save money, what a waste. I'm full of disgust that you would waste our money on something like that. Or if we're trying to work out something and one spouse suggests, well, why don't you write me a list? And one says, oh, so you think writing a list will help you? Like, you talk like that, that's not going anywhere. That's full of sarcasm and cynicism that even as one is trying to work this through, if the other one has taken that road, then it's all over. Now, I imagine all of us have been on the receiving end of that. That's part of our growth as people, is we sometimes allow ourselves to slip. The vocabulary of understanding when that happens, being able to say, putting a stop to being able to hear things like that, we sometimes like, oh, that's a real smart idea. Like, we don't like being spoken to like that. Like, if I suggest something and that's the response I get, oh, yeah, that's real smart, that'll work. You know, if we're in a real good place and we're joking around, maybe, but usually if we're in a real serious conversation and you hear something like that, the contempt that you hear through that, the level of disgust, the level of that's just silly, ridiculous, pretty poisonous. The conversation can't go anywhere from that. The kind of conversation, if a husband walks in and says something like, you haven't even started dinner yet? What's the response to that? I mean, obviously, the missus has been busy. I'm sure with lots of good things. There are kids running around. Like, that kind of conversation, like, okay, maybe you would have expected dinner should be ready, but if you start a conversation with something along those lines, if there's no real good response other than some defensive response, which is just going to escalate it, we'll create that. Here, it is worth stressing that when we speak to our children, believe it or not, if you will pay attention, you can pay attention to others, the way they speak, but especially to our own children, we often say things that are really full of that, full of this contempt, and it is very harmful. It is painful to me when I hear it. I hear it in my own house, and I hear it in others, the way that we speak to our children. We say things along the lines of both criticism and contempt. I have heard parents say to their children, "You are so annoying." Not you are being annoying, or that act that you're tugging on my pants is annoying. I've heard people walk around saying to children, "You are so annoying. You are if you'll walk around Kiddush, sometimes you'll hear it. This is you're impossible." I've heard parents say things like that to the children, which they define the child. This whole bad boy, good boy is like that's like classic stuff. But you'll hear it being discussed. Contempt comes through. That we still say things like this. I've even spoken about this once, and I still sometimes find myself like, how many times do I have to tell you? When you ask a question like that to a child, right? Like, what really do you want the child to answer to that question? That what is that saying to the child when we say that? What are we really saying? You don't get it. And a child does not have to be too old before they pick up that really is the message. How many times do I have to tell you? I can't get through to you. That really is it's a statement that's full of, and children pick up on that. It is a dejecting kind of feeling when we say like that. What were you thinking? Like we sometimes say that to our spouses also. But I often hear that being said to children. Like, well, what did you think was going to happen when you took the baseball bat and hit the baby with it? Now, when that happens, that needs to be addressed. But when you say that to the child, well, like, what exactly did you think was going to happen? Like, you're speaking to a child. You're speaking to a five-year-old, where most people would say that's standard behavior. A five-year-old's going to take a baseball bat, and that's why you only keep small, soft, plastic baseball bats around the house when they're little babies, and they're going to wallop their younger siblings. That's part of older siblings, younger. It's going to happen. Our response can say to the child, you know, we can respond in a way that that's not an acceptable behavior, and we could say it in a way which makes the child feel like 2 cents. Sometimes we give them a look. It's a look that's full of disgust that a child would do something, and forgetting that we're talking to a child. A child might be 6 years old, 5 years old, 3 years old, and we convey often in our words and in our expressions that feeling of contempt. When we receive that contempt, there's nowhere to go with that. It's just a horrible type of feeling that leads nowhere. In Gottman's approach, really what it leads to, if we get defensive when we're criticized, so when the receiver of contempt, where does that lead to? So he coined a phrase which he refers to as stonewalling. So Someone who stonewalls, as the phrase implies, basically just shuts down. Now, he happens to write in his research, he's found that 85% of the time it's men who stonewall, which in effect basically just says, it's as if you're having a conversation and the other person is just not there. Just a brick wall, right? And there's no... You'll read it on your own. Right? A person who gets into a position of stonewalling, there are no cues of conversation. There's no, yeah. It's as if you're talking to the person and they're giving you no cue that they're listening or that they even care at all what's going on. Now, women hate that. Right? That's why we do it. So Gottman writes that that's not why we do it. Now, he has this following theory. The reason why we do that is because we've become overwhelmed. In his words, flooding. In other words, I've been attacked. I've either felt some level of criticism, I felt a level of contempt, I've just felt this conversation is going in a place where I can't handle it, and I've become overwhelmed. You know, there's a book that when I was in school in Georgia State, one of the books, our textbooks was titled Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. It's a cute little book on stress. Why do zebras not get ulcers? So the basic thesis of this book... So why don't they get the bacteria? So he writes basically as follows. He writes that whenever we come to a challenge, a difficult situation, so our body goes into what I'm sure you've all heard of, the fight or flight response. And the body basically gets ready for a battle, whether or not it's going to be a physical battle, whether or not we're going to have to be running. Every system in the body is gearing up for a major episode of something. And whether or not we believe it dates back to prehistoric man, it's irrelevant. We've all experienced that before we're ready for a major challenge, our body goes into a different set of modes, actions, activities. The main thing that stops is rational thinking. All the blood is directed away from those parts of the brain where we're going to stop and think about a problem, rationally be able to creatively solve it because we're preparing for a physical activity, whether or not it's to run, to fight, something. So I forgot the author of that book, but his argument was, as we've moved out of the fields and the cities and into our desks, we're often faced with a very difficult situation, sitting at our desk in front of a computer, trying to creatively solve something when our body is telling us to engage in some form of a battle and to release whatever is going. Our reaction, the type of reaction that we generally need today is different than the one that our body is preparing us for. We get into these stressful encounters, and where we need to be creative to problem solve, everything about us is getting ready for the opposite of that. So Gottman writes, and he's measured the blood pressure and the heart rate and everything during his little love lab as these conversations escalate into battles and heart rates are soaring, what's happening physiologically is that we're least prepared to creatively, constructively, rationally address the situation because physiologically the heart rate is soaring. We're ready to fight. We're ready to run. We're ready to express that. And we're trying to have a conversation. So what happens is everything's a total breakdown. So what often happens is, and that's what he says, we disengage because we can't handle it. We're incapable. One of two things are going to happen. It's either going to continue escalating, or we're not capable of dealing with it. And that's where you'll often get that response where you just totally tune out. Because what you're saying is, I can't really deal with this right now. I'm just not equipped. We somehow sense that I'm just shut down. And there's no response whatsoever. And this is where things, you need to take a break. The key again, what I want to just stress as you go through this is the vocabulary to be familiar. When those things happen, when you see things escalating, what's going on is that you actually become flooded with whatever it is, and you're incapable of addressing it, and you need to take a break. He says in his studies, what he used to do is, as they were doing these studies, when they would measure heart rates, would go over like 100 beats per minute, they would actually, call into the lab where the couple was arguing and say, we have a problem, one of the machines just broke, can you put the conversation on hold for a few minutes while we fix the machine? And then they would monitor the heart rates until they would go back down to a reasonable level. And then they would call back and say, okay, can you continue the conversation? We're ready to go again. And he was right that it's like two different people walked into the room. They had, the conversation escalated. It was like a yelling match. And they took a break for 10-15 minutes, and they both were reading while they were waiting, thinking for the machines to be fixed that they were being recorded. And when they would start again, it was a whole different conversation, because you're able to deal with it. And it is a it's something to be aware of as the conflicts go, in terms of being able to manage the conflicts when they get started inappropriately, when they get started with contempt. You get that in there, you get the criticism, or you get a harsh start, as we mentioned last week, and it just gets started in a bad way, and you can sense that it's not going anywhere, or you see one of the two people involved is no longer there. What often happens is, let's say it's the husband who tunes out, the wife doesn't respond by saying, "You're right, I think we need a break for a few minutes." It's usually a barrage of, "You're not listening to me, you don't care, you don't want to solve this, I'm all by myself," and the husband's just not there. He's totally zoned because he can't deal with it. He's not equipped. It can go the other way also, of course. And the point that he stresses in this concept is being able to deal with, to know how critical it is to be able to step back, to be able to make a repair, what he calls repair attempts. I think I'm going to split with us. Just if you'll flip to page 117 in your little... So this is repair. In other words, the point of this, and the reason why you're both here as a spouse, is because it is a totally valid thing for one of the two spouses to say, "I can't deal with this right now. I'm not in a position where I can handle this." When someone says that, so that's what he calls making a repair attempt. It's saying, things are not, I'd like to work this out, I can't do it right now. I'm not in a position to handle it. One of the key measures that he says when he would be predicting divorce is if he'd be watching a couple and one of the two would say, would make some form of a repair attempt, trying to de-escalate, trying to take a step back, trying to start again, trying to apologize, and the other spouse doesn't let them. The other spouse insists on staying on that level of the heart rate is beating, everything is escalating, and one partner tries to step back and say, "You know what, let's try a different angle, or let's take a 5-minute break, or I'm sorry, let's," and the other one doesn't let it happen. The other one keeps it going. So he says that's always when they predict divorce. You're trying to work it out, and the other one is not letting you, like, "Well, this isn't going to last." And so it's key to be familiar with a terminology to give you almost a vocabulary that someone can say, you don't have to use the terminology if you're not, "Whatever, I'm being flooded, I need a break, this isn't working for me, this didn't get started right, let's try again in 5 minutes. That's a fair thing to say that most couples, I certainly on my own, would never have thought to have done that. You know, let's work it out right now. If it doesn't start well, it's often not going to end well because you're not in a place to deal with it. So we have here a repair checklist, which you could just read through quickly yourself now. You could take it home to be familiar with. Things that you can say that are basically just saying, you know, trying to de-escalate, trying to start again, deal with the conversation, be familiar with this. And if you're both on the same page, and again, you've been working on a friendship where you want to be able to work things out. And yes, there are problems and they happen. When they get escalated, to be able to say and be on the same page to say, "I can't handle this. I'm getting defensive. I feel I'm getting defensive." We all know when we're getting defensive. It's such a natural thing. We've done it 1,000 times in life. When you get defensive, it's not going to be productive. If we'll accept that, recognize that, and know that, when we get defensive, it's not going... Well, if I'm getting defensive, it means I'm feeling attacked. That's why I'm getting defensive. So that means I need to be able to say, "I'm feeling defensive right now," which means I'm feeling attacked. We need to start this over. You need to be able to express to me what you need in a way that I can hear so that I can take responsibility. Because if I'm feeling defensive, I'm feeling attacked. When I feel attacked, I don't take responsibility. I put it back on you. If you can share that vocabulary, then you can de-escalate it before it gets out of hand. If you share a way to be able to have that conversation and start it again in a way that's productive for both. Once with children, we are always on a shorter fuse than usual. This applies, you know, to when you're engaged, you're married, without children. Certainly with children, everything is shorter fused. Everything. We're just more tired, more busy, more things going on. That period, the fuse that we have before we get defensive, is so much less. The ability for us to naturally complain as opposed to be critical and criticize and be filled with contempt is always, it happens much faster. So the key is to be able to have a vocabulary and a dialogue between you that you can say, "This isn't working. This conversation got started off bad. I'm sorry, I made a mistake. Let's start again in 5 minutes." that's a fair thing to do. You'll find it will actually be productive. It's not a cop-out. It's not. It's a natural thing that says, I'm not ready to have this. I need to do this. I need to do this in another time, in another place, in another way, in order to be productive. Those are, at this point, what I just... So those, just to summarize, the concepts that he says to be familiar with in terms of the things that he looks for when he goes through his tapes, in terms of is there criticism, is there a global complaint that's being levied at one of the two parties that's not just saying something happened but defining the type of a person. Is there a level of contempt that's being expressed? When you see these things, either that you're expressing it or that you're receiving it to be able to create a repair attempt. Repair attempts can be small, simple things in terms of being able to just divert the conversation from where it's going, and our task as a spouse is to recognize when one of the, if our partner, our spouse is doing that, to be able to accept it, to recognize it, to read it, and be able to pull back, to allow that to restart in a healthy, productive manner. That's as far as that goes. Okay. At the end of the day, what it all comes down to, in conflict management, just summarizing that, is the ability to accept influence and compromise. Those are nothing new, things that you've heard a thousand times before, but it just needs to be stressed, because at the end of the day, that's what it's about. It's about being able to hear each other's side, understand where they're coming from, recognize that, appreciate that, and be able to compromise. We find it hard to compromise. We find it's a win-lose situation, that we always need to be able to win. And if I don't win, I'm losing. And as you all know from already having been married for a while, it often in being able to yield is what creates, then everybody wins. I always like bringing an example. The men will appreciate this much more than the women. When you have a towel, and you're putting on your towel, and you're about to flip it over your shoulder, and it gets caught on something. So what do you do right then? So the natural instinct is to tug harder. That's the natural thing. Like, I got stuck on something, so what I need to do is, you know, push through it. When you do that, what really happens is generally you rip off a string. What you really need to do when you do that is go back the way you came and unhook it from wherever it is that it got caught. Makes a lot of sense and it's logical. And even after I've said this example a bunch of times in different contexts, the first natural instinct always is, well, if it got caught, I just need to push harder. And it usually doesn't work that way. When you get caught in something, it's often, yeah, actually to take a few steps back from where you came, and you can work around whatever it was that it is, to push forward. We fear losing, we fear giving in, because we're giving up. And very times the things that we argue about are important to us. And we feel like if we don't really put our foot down and demand it be this way, you know, we're giving up on something that's critical and integral to who we are as people, personalities, whatever it may be. But in marriage and in life, it's about being able to see the other side and being able to compromise. The little activity that we started with is a cute little small thing, but that's what it's like. I think we should take this and you think we should take that, and being able to work that out. There might not be a right or wrong answer. And I remember when I was in yeshiva already, as an unmarried bachur, we had Shimon Russell, who's a big therapist in Lakewood. So he came and spoke to us about some other context, but he wasn't speaking to married people, but he mentioned to us that in his marriage therapy sessions, he never cares about truth. He's totally uninterested in truth. Doesn't matter to him. He has two people in front of him. One person thinks that this is what happened. The other person says, that's not what happened. This is what happened. And he could care less what really happened. It doesn't matter what really happened. All I know is that I have two people in front of me. One person thinks that this happened. The other person thinks that that happened. And we need to move forward from that point. What really happened is irrelevant because somebody thinks that this is what happened. And their impression and their perspective and their understanding of what took place, that is what happened. And that kind of stuff happens all the time where we perceive events so differently, being able to see and recognize and deal with that. In summary, as far as that, I want to talk about just two other things after that. But in summary of what we've done so far, that's easy to do if you've worked on the first half of the things, the friendship parts. If you've been working on that, you've been complimenting each other, you've been paying attention, you've been turning towards in bids, you've been paying attention to the last 2 weeks, you know, yes, if there's any homework, there wasn't really any homework, but just paying attention to how each other how you make bids for attention, how your children are making bids on your time and attention, and responding to that, creating a bedrock of friendship, then when you get into these arguments, it's so much easier to deal with the fact and say, like, oh, wait, stop. And the other thing, I'm sorry, I didn't mean, I was tired, frustrated. You can stop that before it escalates. And when you really care about each other, which you all do, and you're working on the friendship, if you have a vocabulary to say, I'm feeling defensive, I feel like I was just attacked, or we need a break, I'm flooded, I can't handle this right now. If the bedrock of the relationship is there, and you have a vocabulary to stop the conversations before they escalate, you'll find yourself being able to handle all those things much better. That's the basics. I highly recommend getting the books. We'll do a much better job at flushing it out than what I've done as far as those two things. I just want to talk about two more things, and then we'll call it there. One last thing, at the top of his charts, which he created in the very beginning, if you just take a look at your his house that he created on page, was it 16? So he created at the very top of creating shared meaning, legacy, values, and rituals of connection. I share this with you because when I first heard it, it had a major impact on me, and it was something that I hadn't really paid attention to. So it could be that I'm alone and that you all would have naturally done it, but it's worth sharing anyway. As your families grow, and you have your own families and the children and they grow older, there's a very important thing of creating a family history, a family legacy, a family ritual, family share meaning, where you've done things as a family, and you'll always have that to reflect back on. Spending a night, and we took our kids to Chattanooga a year ago for a night or two because vacation didn't work out. We couldn't go anyway, so we just went away because Rifki and I needed to get out. And what happened was it was so meaningful for the kids that we had spent this night in a hotel. For them, like, Chattanooga was Las Vegas. Like, nothing could be better than Chattanooga. They have recalled throughout this. We went last December, it was a full year ago. We hear from them regularly. When are we going back to Chattanooga? We just wanted to get away for a night. But it did something, because the family, as the kids have gotten older, the family did something together. And it was something which I personally hadn't valued or seen that as something important to do. But as the family grows, specifically taking the time, it doesn't have to be an expensive thing. It just has to be where it's a specific family activity where families do something, where the kids will always look back and say, these are some things that we've done. It's something which is worth investing in to create that. That legacy almost as a family. And I always found that it takes an investment to do things and create that in which there'll be the memories for the kids. And it's worth just mentioning, you can read a little bit, he speaks about it in one of the last chapters, but it's worth mentioning. The last thing that I want to talk about, which in their books they speak about a tremendous amount, he speaks about it in here. Also, you could look at it, chapter 12 is preserving intimacy and romance in the relationship. There is reality. They have studies. See, they've done studies. Others have done studies. There's a tremendous amount of work on this. I want to mention it here. I'm not uncomfortable talking about it, but it's a public forum, so I'm not going to get into too much details, and if anyone would like to speak about it more, I'm happy to, or you can speak with others. There's a reality that when a woman has a baby, the level of intimacy, frequency of intimacy, type of intimacy, changes dramatically within a couple. A man does not go through any hormonal changes during pregnancy, delivery, birth, recovery. It's just sort of flatlined at whatever it was before, it was, is, and will remain. It doesn't go through those changes. Women do. You all know this, you've all experienced it, because all of you have had children. That creates a very new type of relationship and a lot of tension, most of which is unsaid, because things are different. Whatever was before doesn't apply anymore, and it's a new reality that a couple has entered into almost every time that they have a child. His studies result that it usually takes 3 years before a woman and a couple together will have resumed whatever their relationship had been like before a child. It takes about 3 years afterwards until it's at that same point, which is a combination of hormonal factors, exhaustion, that's just, that's the way that it is.
Getting the kid into his own room.
Right. And you could add, and every couple will have their own issues which will add to that, whether or not it's a child sleeping in the room or who knows what. It's worth emphasizing because it's such a critical part of a relationship as a couple. That's in Torah thought, is just as much as in the secular world, it's expressed a little bit differently, but it is a tremendous part of the closeness, intimacy, the relationship, the passion that a couple has, and it's significantly changed after having children. So it's worth noting, because what often happens, and you'll read this in the books, and I have seen it already in the little counseling that I have done, because it's unsaid, and it's not necessarily stated or dealt with amongst the couple, the tension that it creates, the expectant levels that a husband have that his wife doesn't share, however that goes, creates that. And it needs to be, everyone needs to be aware of it, both from a husband's perspective, being significantly more patient than he might have otherwise been in very different aspects, and a wife's perspective of sometimes being involved, engaged in something that she might not otherwise have been interested in, but that's part of a love language. If that's just like sometimes we make dinner when we don't have to, there are other things that go on. There's a whole dialogue that goes on that's totally changed. That's often a very touchy point, sensitive point, but should or needs to be addressed. So it's worth mentioning. He speaks about it in here. You can read what he has to say, or other things, but I would be very remiss in doing anything about a marriage workshop after children without at least mentioning that that is a significant part that everyone goes through and no one ever talks about. So it's normal and it's a reality. If you want to read more about it, he's got plenty in both of the books on that. Just going over and over and over again how regular and normal it is, and just where it's so much easier to deal with things when you know that that's what's supposed to happen. So that's it for that. Anyone who wants more information, I'm happy to give on that. That's the basic of this. I tried to give a little bit more of an overview as to where this is. You can look at it again. It's worth the review. If anyone would like, I'm happy. I have all the three sessions on tape if you'd like, or a CD, a DVD, whatever is better, if you MP3. If you would like, I can get that for you as well. And lastly, Mordechai Pollack, this whole thing was in conjunction with the Jewish Marriage Initiative, the JMI, has asked me to just pass out a little feedback. Not much. If you'd be interested, I'd appreciate it. And he would appreciate it, you can. And that's it. Thanks for coming. I hope that you got something out of it. Any feedback from me personally outside of this or with that is greatly appreciated. I'm trying to, work this out and figure out the best way to do it over and over again. So.